Welcome to the How to Raise Money podcast for anyone who wants to raise other people's money for a business or property venture. Right now, there has never been more money on the planet, and there has never been more opportunity. This podcast will help you put the two together. So, if you need money for your business or property proposals from banks, lenders, angels, whales, or dragons, this is the podcast for you.
Let's crack on.
Okay. Hi, everyone, and welcome to another edition of the How to Raise Money podcast with me, Ray McLennan.
And it's with me, Nigel T. Best. Raimondo, I am super excited here because I think we're going to find out what the future holds. And it's we're gonna shake the very foundations of potentially everything you hold as being true. And we may even be able to write off our mortgage to boot. So I think, well, I'm hoping so. That would be a doozy of an episode, wouldn't it? But really excited. Ray, do you want to do the introductions?
Yeah, absolutely. We are delighted to have Jason Noble. Jason Noble from inoneplace.com. Jason has spent many years in finance, including 16 years in the Middle East, and has found out some interesting things about the banking system, about assets, what assets really are, about fiat currency. We're going to talk all about those things in this podcast and cover a multitude of things that you probably don't know. And the theme is how to raise money. So if you have money, it's out there and the world is going to hell in a handcart, what do you do with it? Jason, how are you, sir?
I'm good, thank you. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you. Tell us a bit about your background, sort of, you know, earn the honor, as it were, as to why we've got you on here and what gives you the right to tell people how to raise money.
I'm not really sure how I ended up in this sort of position of doing these sort of talks. I've been self-employed since I was at university. I've run many different types of businesses. I used to own a very large security company many years ago. I had a fairly large telecoms company and a couple of other bits and pieces. And about 20 years or so ago, I got involved in private equity work. I actually had clients that had money, and I had other clients that didn't have money, and they were going, do you know anyone that can do this? And I was putting A and B together. And so I sort of stumbled into the finance world. My mum was actually an IFA, so I always grew up going, I'll never do that. I don't even understand what my mum does. And ended up becoming one, but in an offshore sort of market. So I was living over in the Middle East for about 16 years, and looking after sort of high net worths and institutional, later stage the institutional stuff. And a few years back, I sort of started to mix together the private equity side of things and what I was doing and start to build in one place, which is basically a community. And it was designed originally for the clients that I have. I've traveled to many countries around the world. It was trying to sort of find a way that they could all connect and meet up and various bits and pieces. So in one place was basically an online and an offline community that was designed to not really invade your privacy. That was the other thing that I'd also started to realize a few years ago, is that Facebooks and Googles, and you know, to name a couple, have an awful lot of algorithms that snoop into your life and watch what you do. And I've never really been a social media person. I don't like it. I'm not really into the get the like thing. So I wanted something where you could do what you needed it to do, but actually without all the things that seem to just steer you down a path. And so that's where In One Place came from, and it sort of went from there.
Tell us a bit about the fiat currency, because at the moment we've got inflation, and the underlying thread of inflation is allegedly 10%. But I think if you were to, it depends what you use, whether it's RPI or CPI. And if you were to go to the supermarket and get yourself a bit of butter, a bit of bread, a couple of other items, and then look back at the price that they were this time last year, I think inflation is way, way up on what they're saying it is. So where's this going to go? People are sitting looking at their money in the bank. They're probably thinking, well, it's sitting in the bank, it's getting eroded. What can I do with it? Talk us through that, what your thoughts are on that.
About 5 years ago, I started to look at how inside of In One Place to create our own mechanism of currency. We started with a token system where you could buy tokens, and it would allow you to then buy other things, because we wanted to find ways to get people into the community. And it was very infinite at the beginning. But in the same process, I started to study, and I've never really done it, even though I've been in finance for many years, I've never really looked at the history of money and how it all works. And I started looking into currency, and I went back about sort of 3,000-4,000 years. And actually, if you go back far enough, the same things keep happening. It's a cycle that goes round and round and round. And generally, currencies have, in history have always been backed by something of scarcity. So things like gold and silver, obvious. Years ago, there were currencies that were made of things like very rare marbles and shape of animals and all sorts of different things that made it different from something. It has to be able to be tangible and divisible. But ultimately, they start backed by something of scarcity so that there's a limited supply of it. And then someone, usually governments or what's become the central banking system now, interfere with it, and they start creating more of it than actually the scarcity is there. So the Romans, for example, used to get gold coin, which they actually made gold coins, and file a bit off the side, and they'd keep enough filings until they could make another coin. And then before you know it, they've got one more coin than they had a few weeks before. And then they do things like adding in nickel and copper and things like that into silver coins. So there's always been this, it's always been there where they you know, breaks it into this point where eventually what you think is the currency with the scarcity breaks, and you end up with a half-backed thing or a not-backed thing, which is where we are today, and then you enter fiat. Now, fiat basically means it's there is no value in something. So effectively, if you have a fiat currency, it's a piece of paper nowadays backed by absolutely nothing apart from the trust that it will buy you a cup of coffee. But the reality is someone's got the printing press and they keep printing it, you end up with a scenario where they print, and in the last couple of years or so, the Americans, who have the biggest currency in the world, the central currency in the world, have created around $10 trillion in this just over 2 years. They actually are bordering on $31 trillion of debt, and they've created $10 trillion of that in the last 2 years. They actually created more money in 1 month in 2020 than they did in 200 years from 1776 to 1986. So that's a slippery slope that usually ends in a fiat currency becoming seen for what it is, which is worth nothing, and goes back to zero. The fiat currencies have a lifespan of about 75 years. And the easiest way I can explain this, if you created a company tomorrow and we had 1,000 shares, I gave you 500, I give me 500. You own 50% of the company, I own 50% of the company. Now, if the following day I create another 1,000 shares, but I keep them, you've now got 25% of the company, I've got 75% of the company. Will you imagine if I create 1 million shares and keep them, or 1 billion shares, or 1 trillion shares and keep them, and you've only got your 500 shares left? That's the devaluation of your asset over me keeping this thing. So you can actually transfer wealth when you have the control of fiat currency, and that's sort of what's happening. So when you mentioned about inflation is that what you're seeing, things going up, but actually it isn't the value of goods going up, it's the value of the piece of paper going backwards. So you need more of those pieces of paper to buy the same thing. So an easy example of this is that if you bought 1 kilo of gold in the UK, for example, in around about 1960, it would have cost you about £500 to buy 1 kilo bar of gold. Today, it will cost you about £47,000-£48,000. So you're buying the same bar of gold, but you're having to pay a lot more pieces of paper for it. Now, we did a study on a basket of goods about a year ago now, just 50 items, things like a can of Coke and a bottle of water and the things that you would need. And we were at 17.5% a year ago. There is a company called Shadow Stats in the States that have been showing sort of the real inflation rates across the US. They actually put in the US at around about 18%, I think, right now. They're publishing it at 9%. There was actually recently on Twitter, there was a Labour politician that came out and named about 5 different items. And they were, again, things like a can of Coke and a bottle of water. And she said, if you bought these things, and they were mainly food goods, she said, you're at 30% inflation in the UK. So the published number is taken into consideration a basket of things that you might not need. But actually, if you work out the things that you buy, utilities, for example, energies and stuff like that, are up about 57% this year. Fuel's up about, petrol is up about 30-odd%, 35% this year. So it's nowhere near the 10% we're told. And the problem is that if you've got those pieces of paper in the bank, your £20 note always says £20 on it. So you get it out and you go, well, I've still got £20 this year than I had last year. But if your £20 will only buy, you know, 10% less of it, £18 worth is really what it's worth. So if inflation sits at 10%, you leave it in the bank for 1 year, you've actually got 10% less than you had the year before. It's sitting at 20 or 30, you're rapidly losing lots and lots of value.
So for someone that's sitting with some money in the bank then, it's not the best place to leave it. And considering only, what is it, they say that 85,000 is guaranteed. Yeah, I see you're smiling there. I mean, if you went to the bank now, in fact, if you want to go to the bank and take anything out above £2,000, I think you've got to give an explanation or something. And you hear people saying, but it's my money. And the bank is saying, no, it's not. It's our money. So what does someone do? What do you do? What do you do if you're sitting on cash?
There's sort of two factors there that people will probably want to know. The first thing is when you give your money to a bank, it's no longer your money. Most people believe when you hand the money to a bank, it's, you know, I give it to the bank. It's a nice safe place to give it. Those days have gone. Once upon a time, you know, pieces of paper were bearer notes backed by gold or silver. And they kept those notes in a big vault in the middle of the bank. And it was because they were backed by something of value. Nowadays, it's just numbers on a screen. So they don't even keep the pieces of paper there. So they don't actually have it. So if you walk in and go, can I have my cash? They physically don't have the cash because they don't print. There's only about 8% of the money in circulation actually in physical banknotes. So they don't have the cash to give everybody it back. But the other sort of factor is the £85,000, €100,000 type protections that you hear globally. There's nothing backing that. It's backed by the ability to print more money to get it out. And we actually did when we were looking at currency within one place, one of the things we tried to do is we tried to build our own currency, and we decided we needed somewhere to back the currency because we worked out it needed to be backed by scarcity. So we started looking into the top 50 banks in the world. We're like, okay, where's the safest place to go? And, you know, I picked the obvious choices. I won't name any names. But, for example, we found banks that owed 7,500 times more money than they've ever taken on deposit. One of the biggest banking groups in Europe at the end of 2019 owed about 22,000 times more money than they had left in cash and about 1,250 times more than they've ever taken on deposit. And there was one bank in America that had less than about 1.5% of the money in cash at the time, and they owed 216,000 times more money than they had left in cash. And I was just like, that can't be right. And when you start telling people this, people go, well, how does a bank lend 7,500 times more money than it's ever taken on deposit? And I literally went, it says so in their accounts. I didn't know the answer. So I set about trying to find out. I realized that the protection that we think we have isn't there. There isn't a big pot of cash to make sure that everybody's 85,000 is protected. They just assume that we won't have to call upon it. But one of the other things that's also changed is that in 2012, they changed the rules on how they fix this thing from what was called a bailout to a bail-in. So in 2008, when the world went wrong, you know, when Northern Rock went bust, for example, the governments printed money and bailed out the banks. So they went, right, okay, quantitative easing, let's go and create some more money. And we'll give the bank enough money to basically keep the lights on. Everybody was okay. And the government took shares in a lot of the big banks. So RBS, Lloyds, they took shares in nearly all of them. That's been changed. So in 2012, when you saw this happen in Cyprus, they changed to a bail-in. So what they do is that they say, okay, we're going to bail in the creditors, the people that the bank owes money to. They'll be able to go to the people that they owe the money to and say, okay, you need to help us out. We can't meet our liabilities. And the banks can't now be bailed out by the government. The biggest problem is if you work out who the creditors are, it's us. Because when you give your money to a bank, most people think, okay, I'll give it to a bank. It's nice and safe. The reality is that you put it into a deposit account, and the word deposit actually comes from the word depose. So they depose you of your money. It becomes theirs. They owe you the money back. It's a loan. You lend the money to the bank. They depose you of the money, and now you go, okay, can I have it back? And they say, well, what do you want it for? And you go, well, it's my money. And they're like, it's actually ours. But they just don't really tell you. But in the event of them not being able to pay their bills, because everybody goes, can I have the money? And they haven't got it. They can come to you and say, okay, well, we're going to bail you into our problem. and they can give you shares in the broken company and take your money. And if you look on the Bank of England's website, July 21st of July last year, there was actually templated paperwork placed on the Bank of England website for how to handle a bail-in. So don't take my word for it. It's publicly acknowledged.
Okay. So hang on, Jason, you've just probably blown people's brains in terms of, hang on, I give a bank money and it's now not my money and their problem becomes my problem, and that they are trading, effectively they are insolvent and always have been technically insolvent. They're claiming your money is their money. Is this not a case of fraud? Or how would you be able to do this any other way outside of the banking system and get away with it?
There was a great speech in, I think it's 2013, by a guy called Godfrey Bloom in the MEP. He's an MEP, and in the European Parliament, he stood up and went, "This is counterfeiting. In any other word, it's counterfeiting. And until central bankers go to jail, you know, this is never going to come to an end." He publicly stated it in a Parliament building in the middle of Europe. It's great. It's a great speech if you find it. But
yeah, it is a good speech because he's only given 2 minutes to do it.
But he did it well.
There's another
guy that we have on. I mean, we've actually ended up going down a path of, when we worked out all the banks were broken, we've actually created, as part of In One Place, our own banking structure called Sense Reserve. So we actually now own our own sort of banking platform. And we have a business model of, we don't lend money to people. We're wealth preservation. We're just trying to say, okay, yes, if you give us the money, it does become ours, but we will be accountable to you as to what we're doing to it. So we're not going to go and lend it to loads of people. We're not going to borrow on the balance sheet, which is basically what the banks are doing. That's the very simple way to explain it. So we're sort of almost creating a community style banking, back to the days of mutual banking. And in that sort of process, we actually have sort of tried to educate our clients as to the mess that is the world right now. So we do a lot of sort of free information and free podcasts and bits and pieces and Zoom presentations. And in it, we sort of highlight people you should go and listen to. So there's a guy called Professor Richard Werner, who's done an empirical study, so a scientific study, if you like. It's about 14 pages long, quite complicated when you read it. But actually, Richard's a great speaker, and there's a video of him on our website. But he actually clearly states that banks don't lend money, which is another one. So when you go into a bank and you think you're borrowing money from the bank, this came back to people saying to me, well, how do they lend all this money that they don't have? And I didn't really know the answer. The reality is, they don't lend you money. You lend them money, and they lend it back to you. Now, you know, I do quite a long presentation on this, but again, if you look at the simple aspect of what money is, most people think of money as the piece of paper in your pocket, but actually it's currency. It's not money. Currency is the ability to move around stores of value. It's an energy. It's like electric. It flows, but it's supposed to be backed by something of value. And if it's not backed by anything of value, then it's not worth anything. So currency is what a bank will take off of you. And on the British currency, it says, I promise to pay the bearer of this £20. Now, that promise to pay is a promissory note. It's a banking instrument. And it's the promise to pay the bearer. So if I'm bearing this banknote and I give it to you, you're supposed to pay me what it's worth, which is, once upon a time, was sterling silver, which is why it's called pound sterling. So nowadays, if you give the bank the money, they will accept that banknote and say, okay, that's mine now. They'll put it in their balance sheet and go, we've now got £20 more money. But it's not really money, because there's nothing of value. But if you go into a bank and say, can I borrow some money from you? And they say, okay, well, what would you like? You say £200,000 for the next 20 years for a mortgage. They'll go, great. That will cost you £600,000 to pay it back. Sign here. You sign to promise to pay back £600,000 over 20 years. And that piece of paper, which is no different from the other piece of paper that says I promise to pay, becomes a banking instrument. You give them it. They put it into their balance sheet saying, we're going to get £600,000 over the next 2 years, 20 years. We put it into our balance sheet. And then they lend you back the £200 you just gave them, £200,000 you just gave them. So effectively, it's all creative accounting.
And Nigel knows all about that.
Hey, easy, Tiger. What's the end game? So, I mean, what you're saying is, right, this is a house of cards. Something could trip this up. A world event where everyone says, right, I need to hold the cash, the readies in my hands. You know, the classic run on the banks. If fractional lending means that at any one time there's only probably a fraction of a percent of cash in the building, in the banking building, what the hell is going to happen? What's the end game for this?
Without sounding too conspiratorial, and there are hard facts over this, Rishi Sunak, for example, was the head, or was the speaker when the UK was the head of the G7, and announced about the impending introduction of a thing called CBDCs, central bank digital currencies. So, as I say, when I started looking into currency, I didn't really know much about crypto. I now know a lot more. I wouldn't call myself an expert, but I certainly know now how it all works. You know, the world's sort of gone down this path of, you know, if you don't like fiat, go crypto. It's like the people's currency, if you like. And most people don't really understand it. The people that do understand it haven't read many of the regulations. If you look at when Libra came out, Facebook tried to create their own coin. We were in the process of creating our currency that we've created, which is called digital, at the time. And when Libra went bust, and it went bust before it even started, because the concept that everybody's went, no, you can't. The regulators shut it down with an iron fist. They changed all the regulations around the world. And this was in about 2018, give or take. Those regulations haven't really been imparted against people at the moment. So there have been a couple. If you look at Ripple, which is XRP, that's had a really hard time. The SEC have given them a really bad time because they have not been a decentralized system. So the whole thing about crypto is it's supposed to be autonomous. No one's supposed to be able to control it. Most of them are controlled, and nearly all of them are not functionally capable of being transactional. So there's the first problem with crypto, is that you can't actually spend it. And if you think about it, where did you ever buy anything with a cryptocurrency? Most of the time you can trade, but it's not particularly easy. The end game is that I think that crypto has got people used to an electronic currency, if you like, a digital currency, not digital in the sense of a card, in, you know, money and bank cards, but a physical, you know, move the currency around, Bitcoin type thing. And the governments are planning to introduce central bank digital currencies. Now, China's already done it. There is already a digital one. And all of them come with a thing, or are planning on coming with a thing called social credit scoring. Now, often when I talk to people about, you know, the fact that their debts aren't what they think they are, their first reaction is, will it affect my credit score? Like, it's the be all and end all thing. And actually, the reality is that where we're heading is down a path of social credit scoring. Now, in China, if you upset the wrong person, or you even cross the road in the wrong place, you'll be stuck on the news, and they will affect your credit score. Now, they also then maybe switch off your money supply for a week, or won't let you spend your money on things like taxes or air, you know, so they can punish you with your money. They can fine you immediately and take your money out. Now, CBDCs, central bank digital currencies, are coming from the same place that we get right now, the central banks, Bank of England, the Federal Reserve, the European Central Bank. And actually, the reality is, and again, this is, I actually did a, I was asked to sit on a panel a few weeks ago talking about cryptos. And I actually stood in the panel when the Bank of England is not owned by the British government. And everybody else in the room was like, you can't say that. And somebody even went and printed it off and went, look, it says the Treasury owns it. Well, the reality is the Bank of England on their own website says that the Treasury owns the Bank of England. But if you go to, and this will probably be changed if I actually put this out too publicly, Dun & Bradstreet is the credit referencing agency to find any corporations in the world. And most people don't realize that the government and every department of the government is a corporation, no different from McDonald's. And actually, the Bank of England is a primary company. So it's number one in the list. Now, you have things like subsidiaries and everything else. And the Treasury is a subsidiary of the Prime Minister's office, if you actually go looking. Now, they've hidden it nowadays. You can't find it. You have to actually now pay £5,000 a year to get that information. So Dun & Bradstreet have locked this all down. But you know, it is out there. So publicly, I can tell you that the Treasury is owned by another company called the Prime Minister's Office, as is Her Majesty's Revenues and Customs. And the Treasury sits as a subsidiary of the Prime Minister's Office, and yet the Bank of England is a primary. So the Bank of England is lying about who owns it on its own website, and I can quite happily put that out there, knowing that that's a fact. And as such, people think that the Bank of England prints the money and it's the government doing it. It's not. It's a private company, as is the Federal Reserve. And there's a great book called The Creature from Jekyll Island. You know, if you read that, there's actually a podcast version of it on In One Place if people want to go to it. We have a sort of like a YouTube equivalent, an uncensored version. So there's an audio book of The Creature from Jekyll Island on what we call The Watch, which is our, you know, uncensored thing. So again, if someone listens or reads The Creature from Jekyll Island, they'll understand that everything I've just told them is completely true. The central banks are a very controlling factor in our lives, and they're not owned by our countries, even if they're called the Bank of England. So they print the money, and they're heading down the central bank digital currency route, which is those same people that have printed all this money and made a mess, possibly resetting it in a way where they're going to give you a digital version of possibly the same thing. And that could come with social credit scoring. Now, there was an article that broke about 2-3 weeks ago that Rishi Sunak's father-in-law owns a company that does social credit scoring, and he's actually in the running for providing it for the European central bank systems. And if you know, there was a really good interview recently with Christine Lagarde, which I think you've covered on one of your podcasts before. Now, Christine Lagarde is a convicted fraudster. She used to be the head of the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, which is one of the banks above the banks. She's on record as stating when social credit scoring comes in, one of the things they should consider as one of the criteria for your social credit scoring is your entire search history on the internet. And in this interview that she was in, she's now the head of the Central Bank of Europe. So they took her from the IMF and stuck her there. And this guy was saying to her, well, you know, if you look at the chart, it sort of goes like this and then goes off like a rocket. And the EU only started the euro in 2020, so it's less than 20 years old, and they're already 8 trillion euros in debt. So this guy was going, aren't you worried? How are you going to fix it? And she went, it'll come. Don't worry. It'll come. Her solution was, don't worry. It'll be fine. And the guy's like, everybody's going, how? She's going, it'll be fine. So these are the people that are running our lives, you know. Money. I often get criticised by people that are sort of, I call it idealistic, and just wanting the world to not be about money. When I say money makes the world go round, because unfortunately it does. You know, we are controlled by money. If you control the food supply and you control the money supply, you really control everyone. And that isn't being controlled by the people we vote for. It's controlled by private organisations.
Well, as you say, from that book, The Beast from Jekyll Island, the one thing about the Federal Reserve is it's neither federal nor a reserve, which I thought is quite good. I mean, you get yourself up there for misrepresentation in your title almost. But okay, so on the crypto side, blockchain technology, I guess one of the things that is so appealing but also so scary is the fact that every transaction is immediately available and you can interrogate anyone's wallet as such, which means that any transaction that any person does, the government would be able to see what it was and write into smart contracts the tax payable immediately. And any transaction, you pay someone else or the currency flows and the government takes its 8.2% or whatever it might be, and it's immediately in their wallet, as it were. But as you say, you can see the history. This is, for a lot of people, they've probably not joined these dots together. And obviously, it's not something, this picture isn't going to be painted by governments, you know, because why would you want to let people know how everything they do would be instantly monitored. It's interesting, isn't it? Now,
scary.
It's one of the things that, just before we hit record, one of the things that was saying was, okay, well, what's the solution? And I know you said you kind of have groups within your sort of community where you go, yes, it's a problem, but how about this for a solution? So what are your thoughts on some of the solutions for these sort of things?
I think, you know, initially people will have to look at the problem, because the problem usually offers you the solution. So if you know that banknotes are going backwards because of inflation, which is it's a fairly simple thing to measure, that if you hold your wealth in that thing, because you always have, you're not learning from the fact that it always goes wrong. It's a case that there are many things that will hold value, like food. You know, think of food prices right now. You know, food prices are going up. Everybody can feel it. You go to the supermarket, you can feel it. If you hold your wealth in something like wheat or coffee or sugar, the sort of things that basically people are going to need, you know, wheat, for example, is a great one, because it's used often in fuels as well. Biofuels often have wheat in them. So energy and food absorbs wheat costs. So if you look at wheat, I personally think over the next couple of years the price of wheat will go up, where inflation on money will go down. So if you know how to hold your wealth in wheat, then you could potentially go up when everyone else's value of money is going down. Now the problem with wheat is it's degradable, so you can't buy wheat to get in the cupboard and keep it there for 20 years. So then you've got to look at, you know, things that don't rot. And that's why gold and silver have always become money in that sort of state. But, you know, gold and silver is very much a controlled market. It's controlled by the LBMA, which is, again, a bit of a closed loop. It's not what people think it is. It's a bit like the Bank of England. You know, it's not what you think it is. And so the price gets manipulated by companies. And someone like JP Morgan, for example, have been fined 3 times for a thing called spoofing over the last couple of years. I think the largest fine that I remember seeing was about $1 billion. And basically what they do is they create pieces of paper. They say it's gold backed, but it's not. There's no gold backing it. They just say it is a gold piece of paper. And then they sell it into the market to pull the price down. So they manipulate the gold price, and they've been fined 3 times for doing so recently. They've also been fined by silver miners for affecting the silver price. So there is a marked difference nowadays between physical gold and silver and the price of gold and silver on the stock market. So when you look at it, it might say it costs you this. And to give an example, an ounce of silver at the moment is around about $19, give or take. If you bought a 1 ounce coin, it would probably cost you about $30. So you actually can't buy the silver, the physical silver, for the cost of the silver. So, you know, and I think that will continue to rise. And again, silver right now at $19 is half the price it was in 1978. So, you know, name me another commodity on the planet that is half of the cost of what it used to cost to buy it 20, 30 years ago. And actually has an industrial use. You know, you use silver in lots of different electronic goods and cars and phones. And so it actually has a purpose. Banknotes have no purpose. So actually thinking through what you hold your wealth in is probably a very wise idea. And being very careful as to what you go into going forward. I've got a horrible feeling. And again, it's just an opinion. And it's certainly not a prediction. But if you look at this sort of mess the banks are in and the mess that the currency's in, they are doing quite aggressive things that really doesn't seem like it's going to do anything other than eventually blow up. Now, there are terms out there called like the Great Reset, for example, which is from a guy called Klaus Schwab. He's written a book called The Great Reset. He's written a book called The Fourth Industrial Revolution. The Fourth Industrial Revolution actually has a sort of a line in it and a quite a famous video that's sort of done the rounds going, you will own nothing and you'll be happy. Now, they're claiming that that will happen by 2030. Now, you will own nothing and be happy. I don't know many people that actually would agree with that. But there's a guy clearly running around saying by 2030, that's what's going to happen, the Great Reset. Now, I'll tell you a few names of people that have backed that. King Charles has been involved in the process. The Prime Minister, the current Prime Minister, the previous Prime Minister are all proponents to the message that is going on with the Great Reset. If you look on the British government's website and search for the Fourth Industrial Revolution, you will find the regulations for the Fourth Industrial Revolution, which is that book of You Will Own Nothing and Be Happy. And it was posted on the British government's website in June 2019. That's before coronavirus even happened. So this isn't about resetting things because things went wrong in coronavirus and now we've got a bit of a mess, we had to print money. This was being talked about before any of that happened. And I won't, you know, I won't say that, you know, let's not go down that path. But the reality is money's broken. And when it breaks, you need to fix it. Now, you've had to do it many times in the history. And generally, turmoil fixes things. You end up with a mess and then you've got a good excuse for fixing it. So I actually think that the system's being set up to fail. And unfortunately, when the person who's setting it up to fail is in charge, they generally make sure it's in their favor. So if the banks, for example, had a run tomorrow and everybody hopes to get their £85,000 back, I know, and if you just do some research, you'll find that the £85,000 doesn't exist. But people will go running to the banks and go, give me my £85,000. Now, at that point, people's desperation would be, I'll take whatever you can give me to give me my £85,000 back. Well, if it was offered to you in the form of a CBDC, for example, or let's say energy prices become really expensive in the last quarter of this year, and there's a group out there called Don't Pay UK, which have sort of popped out of nowhere and are all over the media, and I'm very suspicious of them because it just they've grown far too quick for what they're trying to do. And the message is good, but actually I'm not sure that the people behind it are what we think it is. But people are saying, don't pay your utility bills from the 1st of October because we have to protest. Well, you're not actually not paying utility bills. You can actually do that. But the way they're suggesting that you do it is very bad. It's going to go very wrong for people. And I would encourage people to think very carefully before they follow that idea. But if that creates turmoil, you end up with fuel prices going up. They're already up about 57% this year. They're actually on course for potentially going up another 70% in October. Now, I think there'll be caps that come in, but imagine if fuel prices go up by another 20%, for example, and then suddenly people go, okay, we will give you some money to help with that problem, but you're going to have to take it like this. You're encouraging people to adopt a new system that seems in their best interest, but actually, if you look at it, programmable money is exactly that, programmable money. And if you just look into social credit scoring, you will understand the fear of what programmable money looks like. So if someone's offering you, and the Chinese did it, when the Chinese came out with their money, they gave away, I think, 200 billion yen and said, here's a bunch of shops you can spend the money in. Here's the cash. Go for your life. So they just handed out free money and went, go shopping. You know, I think the only way to get somebody to adopt a new system that is completely alien to them is to get them used to it. So now people are quite used to digital currency through Bitcoin and things like that. But at the second time is to give them either a reason because they're desperate to get their money back, or there's a helping hand on something that they struggling to pay for.
Wow. Yeah, we have talked about central bank digital currencies and given a few examples in previous podcasts. One of the examples was that, you know, you're driving down the motorway, you break the speed limit, you don't know it because your mind's somewhere else, and then all of a sudden it pops up on your phone, say you've broken the speed limit, you've just been fined 100, have a nice day.
Or you
go to get fuel, and the maximum amount of fuel you can take is £50 because you've used up your carbon limit, or you can't fly, or you go to the checkout at the supermarket and there are certain things that won't scan because you use your club card or your whatever other card you've got, and you've used up your limit for meat or alcohol or whatever else it happens to be. And whilst a few years ago that would have sounded conspiracy theory, you know, yeah, you're a nutter to think that such a thing. These things are actually happening now. They are happening across the world. And I read in the last day or so, in Los Angeles County, one of the counties is now starting a trial of universal basic income.
Yep.
Where they're bringing that in a digital form.
Well, universal basic income, if you look, I think it's next year. I can't remember the month. I think it's July next year. The UK is changing all its benefit systems to be called universal basic income. So if you take anything from the state, you will be getting UBI. So, you know, again, if you make someone rely upon you, you make them needy to you, you get to tell them what to do because you're like, well, if you want that, you've got to do this. And that's, I've been self-employed forever. So I can see when I don't like working for people because they tell you what time to come to work. And it's no different from the government. If they give you money, they tell you the rules that go with it. If they ask you for your money, they tell you if you don't do it, they're going to do these things to you. Most people don't even read the rules as to whether they actually owe the money. I mean, again, not to change direction, but I do a number of presentations, and I mentioned when one of them I do, then I start with all tax is voluntary, and people go, "You're insane." But if you just read the Tax Act, it's very simple. There's the wording that they use is all tax, or a person is required to pay tax is the wording. And if you actually look up the definition of the word person, whether you want to look at it in the legal dictionary, in the Interpretations Act, which is their rules of what they interpret words are, or in the Bible, which is their highest book of authority in a court. In the Bible, it says God doesn't tolerate persons. In the Interpretations Act, it says a person is a council. And in the legal dictionary, it defines a person as a dead entity. So you're not a person, even though you think you're a person, because they play with words. The word require, if you look in the judicial dictionary, the word require means request. And tax is a thing that is asked for by a corporation called HMRC, which is a company. It's no different from McDonald's. So if McDonald's said, "I would require or request you to give me all your money," what would you say to them? So they request you to give you your money. And if they don't have a contract with you, then it actually breaks the Companies Act, which is, again, their rules. So there has to be a company contract between companies. Now, if they're going to go, "You're a person, you're a dead entity," like a corporation is a dead entity. So if I'm going to ask a company to give me money, and there must be a contract according to the Companies Act. And that's the law. That's the rules. So if there's no contract, it's demanding money with menaces. So basically, if you listen to what they're saying, they're saying you are not you, and you are requested to pay something where I'm demanding money with menaces. What would you do? Call the police. It's what you could do, but most people don't. They just volunteer to pay the money, and we volunteer to pay tax. When I say all tax is voluntary, just think about it. It's a self-assessment form that people do when they're self-employed. They self-assess themselves. They volunteer to pay money. And, you know, that's a very brief introduction to a presentation. But when you look at it, we are you talk about money. One of the best ways to raise money is stop handing your money away to people that you don't owe it to. You're paying money back to banks that you never actually lent, they never lent you. You're donating money to a government that actually most of the time takes the money and pays the interest and the money that's been borrowed from the Bank of England. So when the Bank of England prints money, it lends money to governments and banks, charges interest, and that interest rate that you hear going up and down, which they're raising quite heavily at the moment, which is the Bank of England governor does it, when they raise interest, that raising of interest has to be covered by our taxes. So we're actually not paying for policemen, we're paying for interest on the £2.7 trillion of debt we owe. We take about £650 billion in tax every year. So, you know, that debt keeps getting bigger and bigger because they print money to cover things. So it's not all what people think. And you know, when you start sort of explaining this in great detail, people go, "Oh my God, you're a conspiracy theorist, get a tin hat." But the reality is the facts are out there. So if you hear the facts and choose to ignore them, you carry on down that path. If you choose to investigate them and realize that everything I'm mentioning here are facts, then you can make an informed decision what to do with your money. If you want to raise your money, you actually earn quite a bit throughout your life, but you tend to give a lot of it away to people that tell you you owe it to them, but you actually don't.
Mm, okay. Fascinating. Yeah. One of the things I wanted to touch on is we're called the
Hang House. Hang on, Ray, before we leave that,
yeah.
So effectively, we never got the mortgage. We can write off, and effectively, we don't need to pay tax. How sure would you be of getting that through court when you get into trouble? Because you know, at what point do the wheels of government ride? You know, crush whatever legal correct argument you may have, and you may still find yourself in. Do they have debtors' prisons these days? I don't know. But, you know, Dickensian, some sort of Dickensian debtors' prison.
Well, if you do a Freedom of Information request to the judiciary, which is you're entitled to do, and ask them if owing money to anybody a criminal offence in the UK, the answer is no. So it's not a criminal matter, it's a civil matter. And a civil matter becomes very different from a criminal matter. So you can't go to prison for owing somebody money because it's not a criminal offence. So it's just a matter of a contract between you and another company. And then if you know the right, you know, people often go to
hang on, from that point then, not paying your tax, you could never be in prison for not paying tax.
People go to prison for tax evasion or fraud. What happens is they volunteer the information to the tax man and try and defraud them in the information that they give them. If you don't give them the information in the first place, you didn't lie to them. Because you lie to them, they do you for lying to them, not for tax evasion. If you've ever heard of people going to court for council tax, for example, people get put in prison for not paying their council tax. They don't. They actually get put in prison for contempt of court because they go to the court that they create. They sort of argue that they won't pay it, and they do them for contempt of court and give them time in court. That in prison, you don't ever go to prison for non-payment of money. It's not a criminal offence, not in the UK. It is in other countries. I've lived in a country where it's a criminal offence to bounce a cheque. So I've lived in a country where it's a criminal offence to owe money. In the UK, it isn't.
So if we filled out the self-assessment by saying, I'm not going to give you any information,
just don't fill it out. Don't volunteer it in the first place. You don't owe it. Most people fill it out because they're worried about getting the fine that you're going to get if you don't fill it out.
Yeah.
But again, who's giving you the fine, and have they got the right to give you the fine? Is there a contract stating that you owe that money? But, you know, again, read the Tax Act. If you ring them up, they'll say it's the Tax Act. If you read the Tax Act, it says a person is required to pay tax. Once you understand those three words and nothing to do with you, you realize that actually there is no, it's a request. The word require means request. So if someone's requesting you to do something, you have a choice. There was a great speech once, which I'm sure she didn't realize it was great at the time, but Theresa May was on British Breakfast News once, and you can find this on YouTube and places like that, where she stated that we are policed by consent. Consent of the governed is the word that basically, you know, if you, again, and it's a very big story, but if you look at it, every officer of the government has to take an oath of office, everybody, judges, everybody. And effectively, they tend to use the Bible as their thing that says, okay, I swear on the Bible, this, that, and the other. So it all comes back down to that. And so you've got to look in there for your sort of your rule book. I forgot where I was going with this now. But the reality is, if they're going to say you've done something wrong, they've got to prove that you've done something wrong. If the word is request, it means request. It doesn't mean require. And if you're going to go to court, the court has to be a correct court. They often take you to courts that aren't real courts. And again, this is where if you want to challenge this in court, I wouldn't advise to do it on the first day, because it's a dangerous sport. You're up against people that know a lot more than you do. But in the same time, if you really learn your stuff, you can realize that they don't have the right. There's plenty of information out there. I mean, you know, there's a councillor that stood at a council meeting once and said, very clearly, there's nothing in the Local Government Act, which the Local Government Finance Act, which is the one that covers council tax, that says that anybody's obliged to pay council tax. It's not in there. But people just get a bill and they think they have to pay it. But the reality is who are you paying it to and what are you getting for it? Have you ever asked what do they spend the money on? What are they supposed to spend the money on? And again, we go in a million directions to this, but you know, there is a lot of stuff out there that we abuse ourselves. We unfortunately lose our money because we, you know, again, that fine, I think that's where we started with. I said, you put in the self-assessment because you think you need to, because you'll get a £100 fine if you don't. Well, who's giving you the £100 fine? Is it a corporation, and do you have a contract with them? If you don't have a contract with them and you know how to argue that out, they can't enforce it. They try to, but they can't enforce it because there's nothing to enforce it with.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. Well,
yeah.
Going back to what I was saying.
If only I had the kahunas to give it a go. That's all I'm thinking.
There's a few presentations that I do on In One Place. We have a channel called The Watch, which is our uncensored YouTube, if you like. It's like, you know, there's no censorship on our watch. There's a channel called Awareness Presentations, and there's a bunch of free presentations on how, there's one called Fed Up With Fines. And if you watch it, you'll realize how to learn to discuss this thing. You've heard about the fact that banks don't lend money. You lend them money. Now, I don't know if you knew that before today's conversation, but most people, when I tell them that, go, that can't be right. When I first learned it, I'm like, no, that sounds too good to be true. But the reality is, Professor Richard Werner has done a scientific study to prove that that's a fact. I could show you evidence for everything I've said today. This is, you know, brief introduction stuff, but there's nothing that I'm telling you here that I couldn't back up to the nth degree and show you how to argue it. It just depends how good you are at arguing. When you go to court, and again, this is a fact, and again, I haven't got the case in front of me, but a judge in a court case is a referee. Judges hand down fines, for example. As a magistrate, you'll get a fine from a magistrate for things that you're driving offences. A judge, and this is case law from about 100 years ago, you know, in fact, I think it's the 1700s, a judge has no right in a court case to hand out anything. They can't make a judgment. They have no power to issue a judgment, but they do all the time. They do, but they actually have no power to do it. There's case law that says so. So again, if you've got that case law and you say, well, why are you giving me a fine? You have no power to. There's case law that says it. Precedent in the UK does take precedent. They'll have to explain themselves. They'll have to explain what they're doing.
Yeah, I can feel myself shrinking rather than growing bigger on this. It is one of these crazy situations where, is it the spirit of the law as opposed to the letter of the law? And it's okay. Are we in this to try and raise a bit of money to help people out, or are we in this to be very, very self, you know, the clever ones, the big corporations that cite themselves in a certain thing, obtain the grants, do the thing, you know, offset things here, there and everywhere, and end up with a tax bill lower than you or I on turnover of 300-400 billion. Is that just, you know, should we all be that clever? Should we all use those same things? Or are we looking at the purpose of tax to help out society in some way, shape or form? It's an interesting debate, isn't it?
It is. And again, when you start challenging the moral ethics of paying tax, it's a different thing between should you pay towards a community or are you being told the truth about what you're paying for? So I've got nothing. If I want to have a park around the corner and everybody wants to chip in and build a park, fine. As long as the money that's coming from me to that pot builds the park. But if it's funding a war that I don't agree with, for example, do I have a choice? And it should be the case. Now, what our money is being spent on is not what we think it's being spent on. And that, again, comes back to there's a lot of smoke and mirrors. And I'm sure there'll be plenty of people that are listening to this that go, but what do you mean I give my money to a bank and it's not my money? You know, on a very simplistic level, most people have no idea that that's a fact. So, you know, how to rebuild it is a whole nother ball game. You know, ultimately, what we think we have isn't, there's nothing wrong with what we think we have, you know, contribute to a society and build parks and roads. But the reality is it isn't actually behind the scenes. It isn't what we think it is. And I'll give you a prime example. And this is, again, something you can very, very easily document. Council tax. If you ever ask somebody, what do you get for your council tax? Most people will say my bin's getting collected. That's the thing that most people think they get, or the street lights, possibly the police, but none of those things are actually covered. But the reality is when you pay council tax, what actually happens is that you're paying money to the local council. And again, this is another one that would be interesting one for people to look up. Look up your band rates right now. We did it a couple of days ago. And have a look at what Westminster's are compared to what yours are. There's always a good one. You can just go in and you can put the council tax rate where you are. You can put your date in, your postcode, and you'll find what your band is and you'll find out what you're paying. Do the same exercise for Westminster, where most of the parliamentarians have a second home. And just look at the difference between what it is in Westminster compared to most other parts of the country. Now, if you pay council tax, you think you're getting your bins collected. What the council doesn't tell you, and they should tell you, but they don't tell you, is that the companies that are actually collecting your waste are paying the council to collect the waste. They're taking that waste, they're going to waste to energy plants, they're turning it into energy, and they're selling that energy back to the national grid that's being sold back to us to pay a fortune for energy. Now, I'll give you an example. The largest power plant in the United Kingdom is a place called Drax Energy, Drax Power. It was up north, and it burns wood pellets to basically make energy. And it generates about 2,600 megawatts of energy every year. And it's the biggest power plant in the UK. Nothing to do with wind or power, anything like that, or fuel. So Ukraine, Russia, war and everything is burning wood pellets. If you take Birmingham, 7 megawatts of power in
Hold
one
on.
Year
you just
from
broke
energy
up
made
there.
From waste.
You just broke up there. If you take what?
I think it was Birmingham. I just heard the word Birmingham.
If you take Birmingham City Centre or Birmingham City Council, the energy that's generated by Birmingham City Council waste, which is collected by a company called Veolia, who have independent companies. If you look on Companies House, you'll find them. Veolia turned over about £55 million from the Birmingham City waste part last year. They sell it back, and they generate about 170,000 megawatts of power from the waste generated for Birmingham City Council. So, you know, the waste is generating a significant amount more power than our power plants, which we're paying tax to build, and yet we're paying a fortune for energy.
Need to buy some shares in Veolia.
Well, EDF, which is a French company, if you look in, again, you can see this and sort of say, okay, we're being told because of the Ukraine war, our energy prices are going up. In France, where EDF comes from, their energy prices have gone up by about 5% this year, and yet they buy natural gas from Russia to the tune of about 20% of their energy is from natural gas from Russia. In Germany, it's about 50%. In the UK, it's less than 5%. And yet our energy bills have gone up by about 57% this year.
So why is that?
Again, you know, when you start explaining to people that all tax is voluntary and what are they spending on, why aren't they spending it on things that go on? Now, we've sold off our energy to place companies like EDF, which is in France, Veolia, which is a company in France.
Yeah. I've just looked at Borough of Westminster for 2022. So 2021-22, Band C is £735. Band E, 1,011. And next year, it's going to be 768 for Band C and 1,056 for Band E. So, yeah, let's all move to Westminster.
Have you looked at what it is where you live?
I think this year it's but one arm, one leg. Next year it's one arm, both legs.
You'll find that most people are paying roughly double what they're paying in Westminster.
Yeah.
That again, you know, who makes that decision? Is it a fair decision? What? And again, there's a thing called the Local Government Finance Act, which is what they're supposed to spend the money on. If you actually ask them for the bills and say, what do you spend the money on? They'll often go, we won't tell you. But if you actually ever get it out of them, you'll find that they don't spend the money on what they say they're spending the money on. So again, it's you know, it's a personal choice. I have no problem contributing to a decent society, but if you're contributing into people that you think, okay, well, what are you doing with it? And they're not doing what they say they're doing with it. You sort of start to think, and the same things with the banks, you know, paying back a mortgage where they didn't actually have the money to lend you in the first place. Spend your life doing that.
Yeah, I'm just looking, you know, as you say that, and yeah, it looks like where I am, top rate is 3,800, and the band C is 1,600 odd, 1,800 odd. So, yeah, that is
more than double. Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
Again, absolutely. No. I'm certainly not trying to wind people up with information, but information is still information. You know, we do a training program within one place called Knowledge is Power. And actually, sometimes many people are just, you know, you go to school. You know, we've obviously started this conversation in finance. You go to school, very little finance information is given to you at school. You're not taught about money, and you're not taught about the law. And actually, those two things would be quite useful to you if you came out of school with that, a head full of that knowledge. And I don't know if you've ever seen the book, The Rich Dad, Poor Dad by Robert Kiyosaki. But, you know, I've read that book many times over. I've read some of his other books. And Robert Kiyosaki talks about financial education. If you have financial education, sometimes you can work out what to do with your money based upon what's best for you. We often do what we're told to do with our money. You know, you want to borrow money, you go to the bank and you stick it in the bank. It's nice and safe. The reality is, if things go wrong, people are going to realize that a lot of the things that they thought were the best things to do probably aren't.
Okay, so when it comes down to it then, Jason, if people are wanting to raise money, what do you think? Well, the first question, I guess, is what are you wanting to raise money for? And from what you've been saying, it's you've got to think of an asset rather than just to spend it, consume it. So if we're working on the basis, we're going to raise money for some assets, what would you be thinking is a sensible way of doing it? Is it take a massive mortgage, then I'll see you in court whilst I get this sucker thrown out? Or, you know...
That would be very unethical. So, I mean, you know, if people now know what they do and they go and borrow money and then try and challenge it, that wouldn't be, you know, that's not a good thing to do. There are people that lend money that actually have it. You know, you could go to someone and say, look, you know, I've got a plan. I'd like to buy this. If you haven't got any money, you can just do different things to earn more money. You know, many people are scared of being self-employed because they think that a job gives them security, but actually a job just means that, you know, you're stuck on a treadmill. So I think people need to be a bit bolder, especially in today's market. I think that you know, there are many ways to step outside of that sort of like comfort zone that people are comfy in. You know, if you've got a job, you're going to be lucky if you get 2 or 3%, 4% inflation in your wages this year, and yet inflation could be 20%. So actually you get a 4% pay rise and a 20% devaluation of the currency you're earning, you've actually taken a 16% hit this year. So the reality is you've got to react to what is going on. We are not in a normal time. We have a problem. For me, the global currency of the world is the US dollar, and I think it's dying. It's 51 years old. Most fiat currencies last about 75 years. I think it's on its last legs, whether it's next week or 10 years from now. It's going to be a matter of time before people realize that piece of paper is exactly that piece of paper. In 1971, in theory, the dollar was backed by gold, and this French cottoned on to that it wasn't. They parked a gunship in New York Harbor and said, give us our gold. And Richard Nixon depegged from gold. And at that point, the US dollar has been printed into oblivion. Every other currency okay. around the world is pegged to it.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of what you've talked about here would be just perfect for talking to people that have large amounts of money on deposit in banks, saying, look, you might as well, you know, come with me, invest in this asset, you know, joint venture it, whatever you want to do, because anything that's in the bank at the moment is completely at risk and is also being devalued every year with inflation. And, you know, it's such a logical argument. But there's such a generational thing where the belief is, no, the bank is the institution. I've got my trust and faith in the bank. You must find that a lot of people resist these ideas because of that inherent, educated, always told, you know, put your money in a bank. Sure. So how do you find people react to this?
Depends where they're at in their sort of education, as I call it. If you start with someone that's brand new and you sort of say to someone, you know, all of this stuff, most people are like, oh, you sound like a lunatic. If you've got people that have cottoned on to the fact that there's been a lot of things that have happened over the last couple of years that aren't necessarily what you think they would be, then, you know, people are a bit more inclined to think, okay, well, I'm less trusting of the government now because they've done some really nefarious stuff over the last couple of years. So it depends where someone's coming from. The reality are that if you look into the facts, that you can see that inflation is a problem. If you're sitting in a car heading towards a brick wall without insurance and no seatbelt, and someone says, there's the wall, at some point you might go, can I get out of this car? Now, you might not believe me right now, but when you see the wall coming, you might then choose to get out of the car. But your speed of getting out of it at that point is going to be nearer the wall. So whether someone does anything about it now and decides to research at the very least what this sort of information is about or not is their choice. And that's the reality is people are there's a great book that I read many years ago where it sort of explained that everything that happens to you is your fault. And most people like to blame someone else when things go wrong. They never want to look at themselves and go, did I do something wrong there? And, you know, it is only a matter of time before things like CBDCs creep in. You know, Rishi Sunak announced them. There's a public HM Treasury video out there with him talking for about 7 minutes going, CBDCs are wonderful. If you know that CBDCs are coming and social credit scoring's coming and all the problems that go with that, you can end up in that path, or you do everything on your power to not be there. And there are millions of things you can do. And that's where you just need to do your research. Now, whether that's go to somebody that knows things that you can do and say, tell me what I need to know, or whether you do what I've done for the last few years, which is just study like endlessly to learn a load of things that I didn't know a few years ago. Realistically, you'll end up in the same place, or you just cover your head and your ears and stick your head in the sand and hope for the best and hope you don't hit that brick wall. But when you do, it's going to hurt. I unfortunately think that there are going to be many, many people, and I mean millions of people, that will end up bordering on homeless and broke in the next 5 years. I don't think the banking system as we know it will exist in 5 years. I think it really is that bad. Maybe it's 10 years, but I actually can't see it getting that far. And there's a number of other sort of, you know, more acute problems. I did a presentation literally this week or the past week called Early Warning, and sort of highlighted some stuff that's happening this month that people should be aware of and should be concerned of for whatever reason their concerns are there. Because again, it's a bit like, well, you know, there's your alert signal. So for example, the Vatican Church, which is the largest landowner on the planet, have just called in any assets that they have that are not welded to the floor, i.e. the buildings. So any liquid money that they have, they've just called it back to the IOR, which is their bank in the Vatican, and they want it in the bank by the 30th of September.
Okay. Why do you think they're doing that? And when you say that, have we got... I've got an image of oxen pulling wooden carts with some some tarpaulin over the top as they're dragging everything back. I mean, you know, well, this sounds so strange.
It does sound strange, and I don't know why they're doing it, but the fact that they're doing it should be an alert signal. There's a guy called Michael Burry. I don't know if you've ever seen the film The Big Short, but Michael Burry predicted the 2008 crash. It's a really good film. If you've never watched it, it's well worth a watch. But he predicted the 2008 crash, and he started talking about it in 2005 and nearly went bankrupt trying to bet on the mortgage market going wrong. He also was actually very successful in 2001 as well, which most people don't realize. Michael Burry, about a year ago, bet on Tesla going down. He shorted Tesla to the tune of about $750 million. And at the beginning of this year, I was telling people about this, and Tesla went from being the most productive or the biggest company in the world. It was valued about $1.2 trillion. And actually, one of the things that I'd realized when I started studying into it is that if you took all of the cars on the planet and sold them from one company, so let's say Ford sold every car, the value of the market, the real true market cap of the company would be about $300-400 billion in value. That's what it should be if it sold every car based upon GDP and all the things you would work in. Tesla at that time was valued about $1.2 trillion, which had basically been spiked by people printing money and, you know, Robin Hood type traders going into things like Tesla because it was going up. He shorted it to the tune of $750 million, and Tesla's price nearly dropped by half at the beginning of this year. Michael Burry's just exited the market, and he's got one trade open at the moment, and that trade is for a private prisons company. Now, civil disobedience, if you had a situation where you can't pay for fuel, you can't pay for food, what's likely to happen? Now, I really hope he's got this one wrong, but, you know, a very successful trader with many years of track record and very outspoken. If you find he posts things on Twitter, it gets removed, and there's actually websites where you can find what Michael Burry once said that have been removed from Twitter. And, you know, he's a great person to listen to, whether he's right or not. You can get information from a guy who predicted the 2008 crash, and he's got one trade open right now, which is in a company called Geo, and they're a private prisons company.
Ray, how about that for a nice cheery reassuring note of to sort of think, Jason, we've taken up such a lot of your time.
Yeah.
Really appreciate this. What are your final thoughts, Ray?
Well, I just want to say where people can get Jason. They can get him at In One Place, which is InOnePlace.com, InOnePlace.com, where all these videos are under the watch. They are fascinating. Some of them are fascinating. I'd like to end on a positive note, Jason, if I can, because I think you talked about how you can get a 15% return on your money.
The reality of money is that if it's invested well in the right things, there can be returns. So we're sort of looking at different ways of doing that with what we've created. There are many things out there that have done that in the last 12 months. One of the things I showed on the early warning thing is a money markets manager who had actually returned 20.4% in the last 12 months. It's a daily liquid ETF, and all they're doing is moving money from one currency to another. So if you look at something like Turkey. Turkey's currency has collapsed against the US dollar in the last year. And that's mainly down to the fact that they're now having to pay debt in dollars. They have to create more money, turn it into dollars to pay dollars because they've got exposure to the US debt. Sri Lanka fell apart for having the same problem. So the US are very clever. They often lend money in dollars, say you must pay it back in dollars, and then almost create a downside in a particular country's currency. So a good money markets manager, if they know what they're doing, in this one we showed last week, had made 20% return for their clients in the last 12 months in just moving from one currency to another. I mentioned about natural gas at the beginning of the year being a problem if Ukraine and Russia got into a mess. At the time, natural gas was $3 a ton. It became nearly $9.50, $9.80, I think, at one point. It's around about $8 today. So it's still over double what it was back in January. So there's a way that, you know, you're going to make 200% return on your money. What we were talking about on that thing the other day, we're working on an idea around a leasing sort of scenario. So you buy physical equipment. Now, imagine if you could lease cars to somebody, for example. So you've got money, you think, okay, I want it to go in doing something. And instead of giving it to a bank who lend it out on credit cards and say to you, we'll pay you 0.5% because the interest rates are really low, but they lend it out at 30% on a credit card, you do that. So if you lent it out on a car, you might be able to charge somebody 5%, 6%, 7% to lease a car or buy a car. But we're working on something on equipment financing where we believe we can probably offer somewhere between 10 to 15% to the person who puts the money up. So it's peer-to-peer lending effectively. But we're doing it in a slightly off-the-market way. We're not doing it quite the way that maybe people might be used to, but the same thing applies. So again, you know, you just look a bit further. You know, I mentioned, I think, in the presentation about Robert Kiyosaki, and I bought a house for free about 15 years ago, having read one of his books, because in the book, it said, you can do this if you just try. And I went, okay, I'm going to try. And having read the book on holiday, I came back within a couple of months of coming back from my holiday. I'd bought a house for over £300,000 and I didn't put £1 down. So there's lots of ways to do things if you just go looking, but most people don't look.
Mm. Okay, well, they can look. They can go to inoneplace.com and have a look there.
They can.
Well, that has been fascinating, Jason. I think we could talk for hours. We could, because there's so many other things we could cover. I think I can see in my crystal ball, I can see us chatting to you again at some point in the future. I certainly hope so, if you're up for it.
Sure, that'd be great.
Yeah, good.
From our bunkers.
And on that fascinating bombshell, thanks for listening to the How to Raise Money podcast. I've been Ray McLennan.
I'm still Nigel T-Best.
And thanks, folks. We've had Jason Noble. Thank you, Jason.
Thanks very much.
Great stuff. Okay, Ray, so how about that from, you know, that conversation there with Jason? I hope people here listening to the podcast, I hope you enjoyed that. And I hope it's maybe made you just sit up a little bit. Maybe it's just caught your ear. Maybe it's made your eyes widen. Maybe it's made you grab a tin hat and start digging a basement complex. But fascinating stuff, isn't it, Ray?
Well, I think preparation and planning, you know, what do they say about it? You know,
prevents piss poor performance.
That's exactly. Yeah. So preparation and planning. I think it's always nice to hear alternative opinions. It's always nice to hear someone else's take on something. You know, when I see statistics banded around. I'm always like, where did they come from? I always like to check, verify, corroborate, that sort of thing. Most of what he said is you're able to corroborate quite easily. We have corroborated some of it on the fly while we were doing the episode. And since then, I've had a look, and sure enough, you know, what he says does exist. It is there for all to see. The question is, do we want to see it? I think the answer is yes. I definitely want to see it. I want to know what is happening, and so that one can be prepared. You know, he mentioned generators. I've actually got a generator in the garage there, which you know, I've had for a long time, and I fired it up the other day, and it's still working away fine. It's just nice to have it, you know, sitting there just in case anything goes wrong. Most people have a spare tire in their car just in case. Well, what about money? What about assets? What about all these things? What have you got just in case? Well,
yeah. I mean, I've been tinkering on something in the garage. It's a sort of an old pickup truck that I've played the theme tune to the A-Team whilst I was welding on a snowplow to the front of it, putting some tubes on where I can launch oxygen bottles. I've spray painted Mad Max Rides Again down the side of it for that day when I need to pop down to the shops to get a loaf of bread.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, I think it's, you know, these are crazy times, folks, in terms of everyone telling you it's crazy times. If nobody told you it was a crazy time, you'd go on thinking everything's fine. But the fact that everyone, every man and his dog is telling you it's crisis, crazy times, and all the rest of it, we put ourselves into a panic. And at that point, we tend to react. And I think what you should be doing, and I've mentioned this before, Ray, is people should respond. They shouldn't react. And what we're saying here are there are some signals, there are some flags, there are some indications for your next project, for where you could raise money, where's a safe haven, where's a good place, what's a good asset class. These are indications that are coming up, and you should respond to them, as opposed to react. Always, to me, indicates that the event has happened and you're now scrabbling to react to it. Whereas I think if you respond to the way that the wind's blowing or the way that things are moving,
mm-hmm.
then you tend to be in a much stronger position. And, you know, what Jason was talking about there was he was saying, look, here it is, folks. Do you want to join the dots? Do you want to read it? Do you want to respond? Do you want to adjust your strategy to that? Fine if you do, fine if you don't. It's not a this is the only way. It's more a case of this is some stuff that's out there. And if various people of various significance and control and power are making these sort of moves, is it wise to perhaps shadow their moves or be aware of them so that you can respond to things and not be caught out? Because whenever you're doing things, whenever you're working on projects, you're always, you know, trying to protect yourself, but things can always go wrong. And it's how you always respond to these things that is the key. So fascinating chat.
Yep.
I thought it was great. I think, you know, we spoke for about 20 minutes beforehand and about 20 minutes after the recording. So, fascinating. So I thoroughly enjoyed it. I hope you enjoyed it too, folks.
Likewise. And give us a review. And if you want to get in touch, how do we get in touch, Nigel?
You can email us. Just put hello at htrmoney.co.uk. You know, we'll love getting the emails, love hearing what people are thinking.
Yep, and leave us a review.
They're at, what they're doing.
Hit and give us a review and tell us what you think. Okay, well, I've been Ray McLennan.
I'm still Nigel T. Best. Cheers, folks.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to the How to Raise Money podcast. It's made for people who want to raise money as debt or investment equity for their business or property proposal or empire. See you next time, where we can show you how to raise money. There is abundance. There is money enough for everyone on the planet. The question is, who has yours?